Hello and welcome to the Culturefile Weekly with me, Luke Clancy, and some seconds of the week worth hearing. This time, Ballinagh prepares to get its version of the Totally Made Up Orchestra, a scratch orchestra from composer Brian Irvine. Paddy Woodworth puts in a change of mind slip in the shape of his latest suggestion for the Naturalist Bookshelf, and we listen so hard we can hear the Middle Ages. We also begin by reaching into the sonic past. Moline is the title of a new collection of tunes from the Fermanagh artist Rorsch. On it, Rorsch uses her voice and electronics to explore and update the ancient sound practices around keening the dead in Ireland. Moline contains plenty of the shadowy sounds such a project might suggest, but also a strong waft of the incense of humour at the expense of such local shibboleths as the Angelus, RIP.ie, and radio death notices. As Rorsch explained to Culturefile.
Oh, ho, 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 no.
In wakes, I've been to lots of different wakes and funerals where it's very solemn when it doesn't need to be, and it's sort of tokenistic. Like, to me, death is something exciting and should be celebrated, you know? Like, I've talked to lots of people studying the same thing, and they are excited for their wake. You know, it should be a big celebration. They're going to miss it, but who knows? Who knows if there are not? That's the exciting thing about it. It's just not taking it too seriously. It's not taking your own life too seriously then. It's celebrating everyone else's life, their life that they've had. And what a great thing that we can say that we have been alive. It shouldn't just be a whole solemnity festival. It should be a life festival.
Hello and welcome to the Death Notices. We are sorry to inform you, but there will be no Death Notices this morning.
And on the collection that you're releasing, there's quite a lot of making fun of some of the aspects of that surround religiosity anyway. One of the things that you have there is the death notices. How did they find a place in your heart? And a strange death notice at that.
It's mad that someone decided to say that. Like, it's... because that's what it is. Maybe it's just a bit of excitement for people. Like, that. Maybe that was the intention there with that presenter. I don't know. It's one that I heard on the radio. They didn't have a death notices. I just love how in Ireland we have such an obsession with the death notices and, you know, the scrolling on RIP.ie to see who's dead. And it's, you know, it's a constant thing in our house. I'm sure lots of other people can resonate with it. You know, it's there's a game involved every time you see your mom. Like, guess who's dead now? And there's a bit of an obsession. I think it's great how we have an obsession with it. It's a bit of excitement that we don't want to admit. But yeah, like, we are very sorry to inform you that there'll be no death notices. Like, that was an actual quote from the radio. I could be a little, like, remnants of a colonised psyche, a zeitgeist that we're holding on to in a little way, our obsession with death. And there definitely is. It's a funny thing, like, and it should be made. I just felt like I needed to make fun of it a bit and have a bit of humour within the chaos of the catharsis of death. I started with traditional Irish music. I come from a family of traditional Irish musicians, so we grew up with that, and then went on to classical music and started doing the whole grades. And then when I got to kind of late adolescence, I started learning jazz, and then wanted to study composition because I loved making music. So I was doing that in the Royal Irish Academy of Music. Went for 2 years then to The Hague to do composition. So I did 2 years in Dublin, 2 years in The Hague. I went there namely to study with Yanis Kyriakides, and also Calliope Tsoupaki, two amazing Greek and Greek Cypriot composers, and Chus Janssen as well. And yeah, Yanis came to Dublin to do a little seminar, and I was just so inspired by his music. And it was just an amazing experience to study with them. Such a privilege.
Stirring the dough, stirring the dough, stirring the dough.
Well, the current project, which is sort of interested in keening, presumably because of your background, you had already come across that kind of singing. I mean, I wouldn't call it that kind of performance, I guess, and that's, you know, something we could talk about, but that kind of vocal expression, I suppose.
The three last recordings, they would have been the sort of more, you know, responses to the wailing and seeing the dead body. Like it would have been sort of the main attraction to Awake when people would go, and it would have been such a skill, you know, and it's a sacred thing as well, where people were kind of looking forward to seeing the keening. And it would have been passed down every other generation, woman to woman. Even I heard recently the word O'Hon is kind of a mantra that would have been said, and only the keeners could say that word. It would have unlocked like a portal tomb. So it's a really important loss in the Irish tradition.
Tell us what you're looking for in those voices, or what you heard in those voices to begin with.
It was their ability to connect to their voice when responding to someone's death, and how they were able to do that at a wake setting in order to appease the community's grief, because it would have been a community-led event. It's just that intuitive response to something like death, which, as everyone knows, is a really extreme thing to happen, and for the voice to connect to people and to transcend their grief and, I suppose, relinquish their fear of it and coming together communally. They would have, just getting into more research, like the keeners would have went barefoot, they would have teared their hair out, they would have really went at it viscerally and really extremely in order to transcend their grief. So like, how in touch would you be with your voice and your body in order to do that for the community? Like, it's an amazing tradition that I think could be brought back. When I started to learn sound design and using music technology, the voice would have been the basis of how I made my synths or the sort of soundscape. So more so in the last few years, I would have incorporated my voice with all of my music. It's becoming a crutch a little bit, maybe, or just the main kind of thing. Before, in the earlier years of composition, it would have been just instruments. I feel very at home when I'm exploring the voice, and it's always something new with it. Mostly long drives in the car, I'll be discovering something new. So it's always not like sitting down at a laptop and discovering something. It's more natural and organic. I suppose the voice is the thing that connects us to the primordial, I suppose.
Roisch there, and she's on what she calls the Irish Wake Tour, starting October 12th at the Accidental Theatre in Belfast, then on to Connolly's of Leppe on the 25th, the Workman's Dublin on the 27th, and the Wake of the Wake is in De Barra's in Clonakilty on November 2nd. What did the medieval world sound like? Without the necessary recordings, guesswork assisted by close readings of the chronicles is usually the best we can do. But for a new project presented as part of this week's Arts and Humanities Research Festival at TCD, Professor Philippa Byrne aims to see if it's possible to recreate some of the feelings of those ancient sound spaces with careful use of existing sound archives, as she explained to Culturefile.
My work is really about the Middle Ages. I look at the 12th century. I'm really interested in the interactions between Christian and Muslim societies, especially in Sicily. And that's sort of what led me into thinking about sound, thinking about how you use sound to define borders, define groups and communities. Uniquely, I suppose, or almost uniquely, in the medieval world in the 12th century, southern Italy has both large Muslim and large Christian populations. And one of the points of tension, especially as things are getting more tense generally between Christian and Muslim religions, is exactly who's in charge of sound in a city. So the call to prayer versus Christian church bells, the preaching of friars in the streets, who is in charge of determining who gets the right to kind of control sound, and what does that tell you about dynamics within the city? And we have various kind of papal letters about this, trying to arbitrate in southern Italy, in one particular town in the 13th century. It's a place called Lucera. It's sort of in the middle of southern Italy. It's a unique a rather strange place. What happens, essentially, it's not got a very happy history. The Muslim population of Sicily are deported to southern Italy, where they can be kept under control. They're maintaining the religion, and this is one cause of pressure and tension. And from that led me more generally to think about, OK, so how's sound being used to divide up the medieval world? The sound I associate with medieval history is a sound when you go into a library and archive and you get an old manuscript and you have to be very careful because it's quite crinkly, the parchment may be aged, and you get this kind of almost a rustling sound as you try to turn the page very carefully. You don't want to do it too quickly, you don't want to tear anything. But from there I was thinking that, well, sound is obviously this kind of fundamental component of everyday life. And occasionally it's mentioned in texts, in chronicles, in narratives, sometimes as a reference to, most obviously, for example, if they're talking about what will the end of the world be like, what will the day of judgment be like, well, there'll probably be a noise almost like a sort of massive earthquake, like a mountain collapsing and unfolding. And it'll be a sound that's heard around the world, a sound that everyone knows is signalling an impending judgment. So once I started thinking about that, they are talking about sound. They're talking about noise and how noise distinguishes different groups and what it means. I started to notice it more and more and started to think about not just how could we use it by listening to sounds, by recreating sounds to think about the Middle Ages, but also what it might tell us about their understandings. Why are they associating these sounds with these events? Primarily, or at least initially, this was about how do we engage a wider audience. Medieval historians have problems, partly because, for instance, we haven't got a lot of pictures, we certainly haven't got photographs. Often if we want to talk about a medieval figure, we don't know what he or she looked like. So what can we do to think about the kind of sensory experience of the Middle Ages? I began with the source type that I know best, which is the medieval chronicle, looking for mentions of sound, whether that's the noise of a crowd or whether that's the easiest ones to find are the sounds that are associated with saints. There's a kind of saintly group of sounds that you come across again and again. And from there, sort of thinking more broadly, thinking about other texts, one kind of text that's very interesting to look at are medieval encyclopedias or medieval kind of books of definition, because occasionally you come across an attempt to kind of define what a sound is. And that's useful because it almost always kind of defies your expectation, makes you think again about how they are understanding sound.
You wanted to create some sound so that people could have this experience. How did you go about that?
Well, very simply, I'm not technologically an expert in any way, but we now have these online libraries of free sounds, recordings that describe how they were recorded and what they are. I utilise those, I mix them together. And again, the aim of the project is not to say this is 100% accurate medieval bell cast in 1443, but rather this is an attempt to suggest what the text is trying to convey to its readers.
OK, so we should play that guessing game for people at home, like, what does this sound like?
Oh, that's my favourite one, I think, yes. Only because it's the least, I think, predictable. That's meant to represent what the 13th century saint Hugh of Lincoln sounds like, or at least what it sounds like to try to get near Hugh of Lincoln. So one of the unusual things about Hugh of Lincoln, Bishop of Lincoln, becomes a saint, is that he's attended by a swan. It becomes his sort of pet who kind of honks and hisses at anyone who comes near, who the bishop doesn't want near him. But it becomes, I mean, it's associated with him today as a token of his identity as a saint. There are other saints in this period who are attended by animals. St. Cuthbert in Lindisfarne has a good relationship with seals, for example. But here, the sound of the swan is being described as something which kind of uniquely marks out being near or in the presence of Hugh of Lincoln. Big part of the project, I think, drawing people in and making people maybe think in a different way about the Middle Ages. Or if you think, what if this is the sound that's being described, what emotions is it meant to invoke in someone? So I hope it does some of that.
Professor Philippa Byrne there of TCD, listening to the Middle Ages. And next, the moment to get a little misty about the change of seasons. Paddy Woodworth's selection of his latest volume for the Naturalist Bookshelf is one that it took him several years to finish, never mind appreciate, but for every book there is a season, as we discover as Paddy Woodworth offers an apology.
Tim Dee's book, Greenery, Journeys in Springtime, at first delighted me, then it irritated and even bored me, to the point where I abandoned it about 50 pages in. Now I felt bad about this, both because the delights I had experienced felt authentic, and more so because it had arrived on my doorstep as a generous gift from the poet Mark Roper, whose works on Waterford landscapes have featured on this programme. Roper, in prose and poetry, writes sparingly, carefully, clearly, though often bursting into lyrical flight. How could he admire, I wondered, a book that seemed so overwritten, so overwrought, so over everything, and so often? I never had the heart to ask him. Then I met another fellow bird watcher and fellow writer, the falconer Hilary Adam White. While we were looking for, appropriately enough given the book's subject, migrating terns massing on Sandyman Strand, he told me that he had read Greenery with great pleasure. So, 2 years later, I returned to it, hoping to be proved wrong. At first, I was proved right. Delight, then irritation, then boredom. But I kept going. And how glad I am I did. Dee's rich, reeling prose finally seduced me into happy submission to its numerous non-sequiturs, to its periodically outrageous excess of detail. Dee, a former BBC radio producer, created this sprawling memoir out of his pursuit of spring fauna and flora, and very especially of birds, in countries across Europe and Africa, over 50 years. Seen, as I see it now, as a whole, it's a passionate and often forensic exploration of the idea of spring itself, of our joyous celebration of renewal and fresh life. But it also examines, even more forensically, how such a pursuit is shadowed by the knowledge that each individual spring fades and dies, and we as individuals become closer to our own decline with each spring we celebrate and then lose. This grand theme of clashing joy and despair at spring's tricky mixture of memory and desire has a heartbreakingly personal resolution in the book's finale, but it would be a spoiler to tell you any more about that. Instead, let me pick out a few of the book's delights, those passages where you can not only imagine the dawn chorus surging around the globe, but penetrate imaginatively into the mysteries of the intersection of migration and our human sense of the seasons. Dee lives between England and South Africa, and he opens the book watching barn swallows at the winter solstice near Cape Town, in sunshine. This disorientates him. Swallows are so closely associated with human dwellings that for many people, including Dee, their arrival and departure are the key heralds of spring and autumn. This is true of both Dee's home places, but the spring they herald in South Africa is the autumn in England, and vice versa. And because the English spring is the one they breed in, their presence on the Cape Peninsula causes Dee to lose his foothold on the map. He instinctively thinks of England as the swallow's home, but realises that the swallows were where they should be in December, as at home as they could be anywhere. But at that moment, I couldn't see them as anything but away. This kind of telling interplay between the human sense of time and the seasonal realities of the natural world figures in increasingly complex ways throughout the book. He writes of watching a long-tailed skua in Norway. Having earlier observed one on the Black Sea, he imagines it's the same bird. Here I was at the other end of the bird's journey. And yet, he continues, It wasn't an end, for there are none in nature. The bird told me that. And that was the best thing to know in the world. D toys with the striking idea that if you walked north from the Mediterranean to the Arctic at 4 kilometres an hour for 12 hours a day, starting at the winter solstice, you could always be walking where he most wants to be, the very start of spring, for 6 entire months. While he does not attempt this feat himself, he does shoot all over the map in springtime, frequently reminding us that a bird we see, for example, nesting in Scandinavia's late and cool spring, may have crossed the blazing Sahara only a week earlier. Multiply this by 100 species, from woodcocks to ring ouzels, from warblers to his outright favourite bird, the redstart, and multiply them by 100 contexts. Then associate these with musings on writers ranging from D.H. Lawrence to Seamus Heaney, and from Shakespeare to Elizabeth Bishop via Samuel Taylor Coleridge. Then you may have some idea of the rich feast that awaits you in this book. And if you digest it slowly enough, whatever age you are, I think you will come to a point where you grasp what Dee means when he writes that spring means more to me with every year that passes and takes me deeper into my own autumn.
Paddy Woodworth there offering the consolations of Tim Dee's Greenery, Journeys in Springtime, as his latest suggestion for that groaning piece of imaginary furniture we call the Naturalist Bookshelf. One way to be a slightly bigger version of yourself, that's the promise of the Totally Made Up Orchestra, a project of the Ivor Novello Award-winning Belfast composer Brian Irvine. For several years, Irvine has been calling together players of all levels and none to devise and play a new work in an afternoon. Irvine's Totally Made Up Orchestra has become a staple of the New Music Dublin Festival and now brings its special recipe to Ballinar as part of the Ballinar Fringe Festival, where they're currently recruiting folks just like you to become a slightly bigger version of yourself. Brian Irvine spoke to Culturefile about his history with the freest of free music projects.
I did quite a long residential in Hull when it was City of Culture. Over a period of about 6-9 months, I can't quite remember, I was partnered with two hostels that really addressed homelessness and rehousing and addiction. And I worked with a group of young primary school kids in a fairly virtually marginalised area of Hull. I worked with them all individually, and then I made one big band out of a lot of them, where we all kind of performed as one thing. That happened over quite a long period of time. So the Totally Made Up Orchestra in Dublin, I think, maybe came after that. But of course, I'd done a lot of Totally Made Up Orchestra type things with another orchestra that I had called the Tolbooth Sound Orchestra, which was based in the Tolbooth in Stirling. So I'd already done a lot of those things, you know. It was really an idea that John Harris, who's the director of New Music Dublin, and myself conjured up, I think, at the first New Music Dublin festival that he was the director of. I had run different kinds of ensembles like that, you know, and the idea was a very simple idea, and that was start an orchestra. The criteria for joining the orchestra was any age, any ability, any instrument. The whole focus of it was a sort of that we get together, completely unknown collection of whatever, and we have 3 hours to make some work, and then we perform the work 3 hours later. I think the first session we have about like 12 people on it. The last Totally Made Up Orchestra session we did, you know, had about 60 odd people on it. So it became like a sort of stable of the New Music Dublin, and it always was, it always is quite an event. Thank you. I love making noise with anybody who wants to make noise, and that could be an orchestra or a punk band or whatever. And the thing about the totally made up orchestra is that you really don't know what combination of noises you're going to get, and that always seems like a direct route to making something which is extraordinarily unique, because perhaps there have never been this particular combination of instruments or noises. And so it always strikes me as extremely exciting that we're going to combine all this to make something. And just by the construct of the orchestra, it's going to be like nothing you've ever heard before. My background is really one of a sort of punk musician who then got heavily into free music and improvised music, especially people like Sergei Koryukin, you know, from Russia, who had these brilliant shows called Popular Mechanics, you know, which would have a band and then a string quartet and a group of nuns and a few penguins on stage. He would make these amazing kind of shows, and I remember seeing that a long, long time ago, and just thinking, oh yeah, that's the way forward. I became more aware of other scratch orchestras, but nothing ever really got me excited as much as Sergei Koryukin and his Popular Mechanics. And so I always have that, I suppose, as my first reference point, you know, and the whole sort of, you know, garage band thing, you know, where you get together with your mates when you can't play an instrument and you get in a garage and you make a big racket. I still think that that's the most exciting way to make music. Well, one of the most exciting ways to make music.
One of the things about it is that there was this kind of thing in art about relational art, where, you know, the kind of social relations between the people involved became as important as whatever was put in the gallery or on the stage. It's like an orchestral version of relational art, maybe.
Yeah, I mean, I totally. I mean, I think when I think of what actually happens in those totally made up orchestra sessions, it relies fundamentally on examining ways to connect and communicate together with strangers in a way which is kind of exhilarating, and this sense of a collective journey. I would welcome anyone to come along. All you really need is a sense of fun and a sense of adventure, and bring any instrument that you want. All that you really need is a sort of open heart and an open mind, but maybe more an open heart and just a sort of sense of adventure.
Brian Irvine there, and the Totally Made Up Orchestra will cook up their particular soup in Ballinagh as part of the Ballinagh Fringe Festival next Sunday, 6th of October, in Kennedy Glasgow House, Ballinagh, County Mayo. And that brings to an end this edition of the Culture File Weekly. We'll be back with more riotous assemblies next Saturday tea time. Till then, bye now.